Welcome everybody to Mike TV episode 22, in which we will be discussing HBO's Watchmen season 1 episode 2, entitled Martial Feats of Comanche Horsemanship. My name is Lisa, and joining me as always is Dean. Hello, Dean.
Hey, Lisa, how you doing today?
I'm so good. A little scratchy throat, so I hope everybody can bear with me as the seasons change here in Georgia. So does my voice, as my sinuses are affected, but we're going to get through it.
That time of the year in Georgia when it goes from summer to winter.
Mm-hmm. Overnight, literally. Happens every year on Halloween, doesn't it? We're recording this the day after Halloween, I should mention. So I hope you guys had some fun trick-or-treating.
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of candy. Passed out a lot of candy. But definitely trick-or-treating stopped at like 8 o'clock, like all around the neighborhood. I mean, people were done. They were too cold.
Yeah, it was very cold, very cold. So anyway, well, we're not here to talk about Halloween. We're here to talk about Watchmen, our new favorite show on HBO right now. I absolutely loved this episode. Again, you're going to be hard-pressed to find it, me saying anything negative about this show. I thought episode 2 lived up. It was a great follow-up to just the great premiere. I have lots and lots to say about it. I had a lot of fun. I've watched it 3 times, and once again, just keeps getting better and better upon rewatch. How about you?
I thought it was great. I thought they did a good job of diving into the mystery of following Angela, trying to figure out who killed Judd from the last episode. They didn't do anything too crazy or weird to try to drive off too many fans. I think they put a lot of, you know, if you made it through the squid rain in the first episode, there was nothing here to drive you away.
And I have some updates from our last podcast. I believe news. Tim Andrews is back in on this show. So that's
right?
Good. I think we wore him down. We did it. Or else Jeff did.
Either that or he just actually sat down and watched it.
Yeah, exactly. My husband's maybe a little bit more in on the show as he's watched a little bit of it now. So
I was picking at him yesterday. We had a Twitter conversation behind the scenes, and I picked at him a little bit about it.
Well, he deserves it. What he doesn't want to admit is that he's going to sit down and actually have like appointment viewing, you know, for television. Right. He refuses to conform. But let's just say if I have it on and he's around, he usually sits down and takes notice. So I'd say he's pretty up on the show. But I think it's safe to say for all the Radio Labyrinth fans listening, we've got Tim Andrews in. So that's good. That's good news. I imagine they'll be talking about it on this week's Radio Labyrinth, which will probably air before this episode. So, you know, we're speaking to you from the future now. All right, so let's get into it, shall we?
Let's go.
So great opening scene. We see a lot of ladies typing, old-fashioned typewriter style, old-fashioned style when only ladies sat in a room and typed together. So we know we're in the past. Fun little clever way they typed out the opening title. As a typewriter font this time, saying Watchmen. I think we're going to get different title sequences with each episode, which I love.
I know they're vying. They're trying to battle Legion to see who can have the best title sequences.
They are, and they're hitting it too. So I guess we'll sum up which title by the end of the season, which title sequences did we like better, Legions or Watchmen? Watchmen certainly giving them a run for their money. Oh, I should say a little bit of information that I did find out about the show, and I know you've done a lot of deep dive reference fact finding as well, so we'll hit on that throughout the episode. But I did find out this show is only going to be, this season rather, is only going to be 9 episodes, so I'm sad about that. I of course want more. Additionally, Damon Lindelof has said that he has designed this season to be a standalone season, that it could be considered a complete season or a complete show if, in fact, it doesn't get renewed, which, of course, HBO would be stupid not to renew it, but stranger things have happened, I guess.
Right. Yeah, from everything I've heard, the ratings for these first two episodes have been crushing it. So I think they even had, I want to say the premiere was one of their highest premieres on HBO. So if they're able to turn this into a Game of Thrones-esque level interest piece for a lot of people, they're going to keep, I think it's going to get at least 2 to 3 seasons.
It deserves it.
And I hope Lindelof does kind of like what he did with The Leftovers too, where he realizes maybe after the second one, we'll have one more, or we're only going to do 2 to 3. He's smart enough that if he can win over all the Watchmen purists to actually get into this, he's certainly not going to push his luck to drag it out farther than it needs to be.
Well, so the other thing supposedly that he has said is that his intention is to only do one season, and that because it's such a robust writer's room, that he's got the confidence that if it does get picked up for other seasons, he's going to pass the buck to a different showrunner and gracefully bow out.
I wonder if he would pass it to, I think it's Nick Cuse, Carlton Cuse's son, who writes he wrote a lot of Leftovers with him, and I think he's kind of the co-runner with him now.
Yeah, that would be really good. He's also talked about, what is it, Coogler, the guy who did Black Panther. Mm. His name has been brought up.
Hmm. Well, as long as they don't fuck it up like True Detective Season 2.
Oh, I liked some of True Detective Season 2, so I can't get on that one. So, all right. So, well, I would certainly hope that Lindelof will choose to do more than just one season. I mean, I definitely want more than one season, but I definitely hope he'll stay on. So maybe that's just Lindelof being Lindelof. You never know. Right. I mean, you're right. It's exactly what he did with The Leftovers, although he did do all 3 seasons of The Leftovers. But he did create them to be standalone seasons that could potentially be series ending. So that's to say, I believe we will get proper answers to all of our questions within this first season, these first 9 episodes. So everybody who is still just buzzing with questions and can't handle the mystery, you know, just see it through. You're going to get the answers.
Right.
All right, so back to our room of lady typists. This is clearly a time around World War I. They're in Germany, and a World War I German officer or commander walks in and asks for Fräulein Müller or Mueller, and asks that she is fluent in English. She says yes. So he pulls her into another room to type out what can only be described as their propaganda that they dropped on black soldiers. It's a great read-through of this letter. That's the backside of the Watch Over This Boy letter that we've seen all through the first episode. So it starts with the German commander reading out what the letter says, into Will's father marching on the field, reading the letter as it's dropped from the sky, from the plane, and then into Will as a little boy, continuing to read it as he finds it in his father's jacket, and then, of course, finishing up by Will as an old man, played by Louis Gossett Jr., reading it as he's waiting below the hung tree with Judd's body. So, Fräulein Müller, is it Müller or Müller? I can't remember. I think it's Müller. Müller is a significant name from Watchmen canon, correct?
Yeah, it actually comes up a little bit later in the episode.
Correct. And then, okay, so put a pin in that. And the other thing I was going to say about this this visual here, this opening scene, is what an interesting visual shot. I love the real interesting camera angles that this show and so many others experiment with and find, but they definitely found a cool one while the commander is dictating the letter as the woman types it at his desk. You get this shot of him through a magnifying glass. So it's like you see his face and then his face coming through the magnifying glass, which is now upside down through the reflection in the magnifying glass. Did you catch that shot?
Yeah. Would you say it's through the looking glass?
I would say exactly that's what it is. It was so cool, though. Very cool. So a discussion on this propaganda, you know, we know this happened, right? The Germans did do this. So it goes on and on, just it calling them boys. It's addressed to the colored people of America, colored soldiers of America. And he's, you know, saying, you know, boys, we treat our colored men with respect over here. You're given positions of prominence. What are you? You're treated like a second class citizen in America.
Yeah, right. And to drive that point home, the white kind of commander or something spits in his face as he's walking by him.
Yeah, and Will's father's face. Yeah. So, I mean, it was, you know, hard to hear that, and hard to think that people fell for that. It kind of ends at the end with, to carry arms in service of America is not an honor, but a shame. So come over and march with our men. And I got to believe this really happened, right?
And yeah, it did. And especially in World War, you wouldn't think, I mean, I guess a lot of people would probably think it's silly because you just automatically think Germany and Nazis in World War II, but this was a different group of people in World War I. You know, different leadership. Right. It wasn't the same. The anti-Semitism, I mean, it was probably there some, but it wasn't like how it was as far as the Aryan race, you know, Third Reich stuff.
Right.
And, you know, this is like the 19 teens, so you're still less than 50 years removed from the Civil War. We think about how much racial tension there is just from the 70s and that, mm-hmm. but I mean, you're still 50 years within the Civil War. The soldiers' parents were slaves. Some of them may have even been born as slaves. So yeah, it's crazy to think that then they're over there fighting for a country that they may, you know, not care about. And the fact that they're fighting and dying for the country, and there's people not appreciating that.
Yes. And it definitely blurs the lines of what we think about when we think about racial prejudices, and especially coming out of Germany.
And again, I think it uses the racial backdrop because that's kind of the backdrop we're using, but if you even take the color of the man out of it, you know, we see this all the time with our own soldiers still today, that they volunteer now to fight for our country and they don't get respect from certain people. They're, you know, chastised or, you know, not appreciated. Police officers, right. Firefighters not being appreciated for what they do, putting their lives on the line. And and even in the course of the show, the police now are hated by a lot of people. The heroes were hated by a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. It definitely is creates that again, that blurred line between right and wrong and black and white. And yeah, this definitely themes this show is going to continue to explore, which I'm excited about.
Yep.
All right. So back at the hanging tree, there's Louis Gossett Jr., whom we now know is named Will, still sitting there with his arms out. This is, you know, we get the scene again of Angela, you know, saying, turn off the light or I'll shoot. And as she walks up to him in his wheelchair and starts to push him away from the tree, wheel him away from the tree, that's when we get the title card reflected on the tree, Martial Feats of Comanche Horsemanship. It's quite a mouthful.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about where that title comes into play in the episode. But I was at first intrigued about that title. I was like, why is it called this? So kind of an interesting title there. But Angela wheels him to her car, and then we see them driving to the bakery. And once inside of Hanoi and Milk, she handcuffs him to the bar. He's still in mm-hmm. his wheelchair, of course. So she handcuffs him to something there in the bakery. Searches his pockets, starts a cup of coffee for him in her Keurig, and in the time that coffee's brewing, she goes into her secret room, has a guttural outcry over the death of Judd. I mean, she really loses it there for a minute.
Right.
And then changes into her Sister Knight outfit and goes back out to interrogate him.
Yeah, this is one of a few times we kind of see not just her, I guess, we see it with Looking Glass too, but just trying to hide the emotion or to keep mm-hmm. the emotion from clouding everything they do. Even the fact that she has to go immediately put on the Sister Knight uniform is like her armor. You know, she's putting on that body armor to make sure that she doesn't seem vulnerable to him.
Yeah, it was interesting, and I enjoyed the scene again, seeing her get ready. We got a little bit more detail right. of it than the last one. This time, even seeing her spray her face, yeah. that was very cool. All right, so back to interrogating Will. She says, "Who are you?" He keeps insisting he's the man who hung her chief of police. She says, "Bullshit, you're like 90 years old. There's no way you could have done it." He says, "I'm 105 and you curse too much." So finally she asks him how did he do it? Okay. And he says, "Oh, you know, it's the psychic powers that I have, yeah. you know, cause I'm Dr. Manhattan. Yeah. That's the ticket." We got a little bit of interesting details about Dr. Manhattan. He says, but he's on Mars. Or she says he's on Mars, and then she also says, but he also can't look like us. And I should have said when she also searched his pockets and pulled out a bottle of pills and plus the note.
Right.
This note, again, is going to follow these characters all the way through this episode. So when I say the note, it's the note. I just know it's the note. Finally, he says, "Can I have one of my pills?" She had the pills and the note over on the counter. And I love this line. She says, "Why don't you just use your powers and float them on over?" To which he finally fesses up that, okay, he's not Dr. Manhattan and he really doesn't have the psychic powers, but he does need the pills for his memory.
Right. Which already, one, makes him an unreliable narrator if he's having maybe Alzheimer's or some other kind of issue with his memory. And the fact that he's already straight lined to her, or we assume he's straight lined to her. So
yeah,
he's already making himself like, can we ever believe anything he's saying, whether he is intentionally or whether he just thinks that he's telling the truth, but maybe he's not. So I think that is going to play into a lot when we try to find out if he's actually, legit or not.
Yeah. Well, by the end of the episode, he's definitely something.
Right, yes.
So she continues to just question him about, if he did do it, she still clearly doesn't believe that he's the one that actually killed Judd. But finally, she says, okay, why'd you do it then? And Will says about Judd that he had skeletons in his closet and there's a vast conspiracy going on that I have to tell you about, but I have to give it to you in pieces. Otherwise your head would explode. So that's a little interesting there that, she's interrupted at this point. I would have liked to have heard her continue to interrogate him, but I wish she had gone back to this when she says, I need to know about this conspiracy.
Right.
She didn't have enough time to get this information out of him, but seems to me it should have been top of mind when she went back to see him toward the end.
Right. I also got the feeling that, you know, because the concept of Watchmen, the graphic novel, was that it was a look in the mirror to other comics and graphic novels and what almost taking them on. And so this is kind of supposed to be a look back on visual media or, you know, TV and movies of superheroes. I almost felt that was a kind of a wink toward that, as far as like, oh yeah, it's going to be this huge, super awesome, crazy thing, but I can't tell it to you right now.
Yeah.
Because it's so crazy that your head would literally explode. So I'm going to have to give it to you week by week. You can't binge it.
Good.
That's why it's not a binge show. Like, you're going to wait each week and then watch it.
Kind of like American Hero Story, too, opened up with a little bit of that. Like, you know, the show within the show, which we'll get to, which was one of my favorite parts. Kind of doing the, I can't tell you everything now, otherwise you wouldn't stay till the end.
Right.
So very meta, very meta commentary. That was a good catch there. So then at this time, Angela gets the page, the official page, and that's when she, quote unquote, learns about Judd. So she leaves Will in the bakery and heads to the crime scene, but not before she puts that coffee mug that he was drinking out of into a plastic bag and takes it with her.
Yeah, slick move.
Mm-hmm, very slick, very slick. So cut to a amazing scene. It was so brief, but it was so important. And this is the newsstand scene. I loved this scene. I hope we get more of these characters. I feel like we will, of the young girl, but we hone in on a newsstand. First zoom in on a newspaper headline that says global squid falls battle, or excuse me, baffle scientists. Global squid falls baffle scientists.
Right.
And I should say, it's very interesting. Of course, this newsstand is popping with newspapers, something we definitely don't see much of anymore in our time. But remember, this is a timeline without internet. So people are still getting their news from newspapers. So
right. So I want to go pop in real quick and mention this, because we talked about it at the end of last show, and I'm going to reference it several times, not just today, but I'm sure we'll reference it a lot moving forward. But if you're watching the show and you're watching it enough to where you listen to a podcast on it, you also need to go online to hbo.com/pedipedia, P-E-T-E-Y-P-E-D-I-A, and it's a supplemental website that HBO put together.
And we have it in our show notes, too.
Yes, and every week they release a file, and the file usually has 2 to 3 links of, like, memos or articles. Some of them are articles from the show. In fact, one of last week's article was the Veet declared dead that we actually see Will holding.
Right.
This week's was Judd's obituary, or at least the report of his death, not necessarily a straight obituary. Mm. And there's a lot of other files put in place. One of the things we talked about last week was why there's no technology. And you kind of made the guess that maybe it's because there wasn't Al Gore. Well, sure. If you remember, they talk about how the batteries, the old batteries cause cancer. Mm-hmm. So those batteries were part of the technology that Manhattan and Veet created in the comic. And once, and then if you remember, Veet faked the fact that Dr. Manhattan caused cancer toward people that he was near.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So that was one thing. They thought anything that was Manhattan powered could cause cancer. So technology was already starting to get a hit there. And then the whole interdimensional incident or encounter, whatever it was called, it is basically what was blamed for it was technology. The fact that we had all this crazy technology, it opened up a rift into extra dimensions. And so basically the whole world went like they just threw
They're
away
afraid.
Technology.
Yeah.
They tore down, and he mentions, so this one file is a file, it's a memo going out to FBI agents talking about the introduction of computers, like they're going to reintroduce computers. And it says in 1993 there was the Tech Recall and Reintroduction Act, and it was a 30-year plan outlined to basically study, deem technology not to be unsafe, and to reintroduce it into society. But they basically went to the, like, no other than lights and things like that, they got rid of phones, they got rid of computers, they tore down radio towers and things like that. So that's why there's still such a big newsstands. That's why they have the pagers instead of cell phone use or anything like that.
Wow.
So technology's barely coming back. Yeah.
Yeah. It's good world building. It makes perfect sense. I love the Wikipedia files.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of little nuggets in here too, as far as the Surgeon General, who is deeming that you will not get cancer from computers now. Surgeon General Oz. Dr. Oz.
Yeah.
So yeah, a lot of cool stuff in here. About
hey, that. That's the reason for Autumn to watch this show now.
Yeah. It's got Dr. Oz on it.
Well, that's awesome. That makes perfect sense. Yeah. And because I think of what Dr. Manhattan is and what he stands for, it makes, and how his impact affected the quote unquote quote world of the 80s, the time frame of the 1980s, it makes sense that 40 years later, or you know,
right,
people would just now start to be accepting technology.
Right. Even the conclusion, the last line was that they thought that once the squid fell, they thought getting rid of the computers, the phones, the towers that would have provided communication without wires, we destroyed it all, hoping it would save us. And yet, baby cephalopods still rain from the sky. Our fear of technology was for naught. So they have no idea why it rains. It mentions that they always dissolve into water, so they can't study them.
Yeah, and you mentioned that too. So that's very interesting. And then so the newsstand owner is speaking with, you know, possibly like a delivery guy
right.
or somebody there about this, you know, like I'm calling it the squid hoax.
Right.
And the one guy says, oh, coordinated attacks happened all at the same time in Tulsa, Vancouver, Jakarta, and Leningrad. Now, I don't know my history as well as I should, but I know Leningrad is no longer a city.
Right.
So this changed, that city changed with the fall of the Soviet Union, or the fall of, is that correct?
Yeah, which I'm assuming if we made peace with Russia in 1985, maybe we didn't force them to.
Right. So Leningrad is still a thing.
Right.
So the other guy says, so this, I don't know anything about this interdimensional shit. You know, I'm not a scientist. I can't explain it. And the newspaper stand owner says, I think it's a false flag. And so he said, you know, this is all part of Redford's
right.
big conspiracy. And the guy there, the delivery guy says, oh, so then I guess you're a Keene man.
Right.
I guess you're going to be voting for Keene. And the newsstand owner says, no, fuck Keene also. So, you know, so he's, you know, apolitical. I like this right. guy already.
Yeah, I think these guys, there was a version of these guys in the graphic novel. Like there was a newsstand they always cut to with two guys always talking. And I think they kind of represent almost like what the everyman in this right. you know, in this world is like, kind of how they're just perceiving everything that's going on. So it kind of gives us what do people actually think about like random, you know, random regular people, mm-hmm. not the extremists on one end, but like, what are just random people thinking about all this craziness that's going on? So I think they kind of give us a voice of the population in this world.
Yeah, that's good. Like all of the 24-hour news networks that are so disassociated from the real general right. public, right?
Yes.
All right. Okay. So curious to learn more about this young girl who pulls mm-hmm. up, jumps out of the back of a car, perhaps like a limo. She's dressed almost like a Girl Scout uniform.
Right.
She's got a beret and a sash on. She's adorable. And the newsstand owner hands her a large stack of papers and asks the young girl, does whomever she's bringing these to, it's implied that she's bringing them to a woman.
Right.
And he says, does she really read all of these? And the young girl says, of course, don't you? And he responds, I read, I just don't believe.
Right.
So whomever she's taking those newspapers to, that's going to be a thing, I believe. So we'll keep an eye out on that.
Right.
So back at the crime scene, Crawford is still hanging from the tree. Angela pulls up in her car. It's quite a police scene there. They've done a good job blocking it off from the public. But of course there's lots of hungry reporters waiting the wings, but
literally.
Angela gets, we'll get to some of those, but Angela does get through all the kind of barriers and in her car pulls right up. Before she can even get out of her car though, LG jumps in the passenger seat. Funny little bit where he asks her if she's got any food and she says she's got some nuts in the glove.
Yeah.
It was a weird line, but it was funny.
Well, even him walking, even him just the first thing he says, you got any food?
Like, yeah, I love him. I love him. I want to see so much more of him. So he pulls his mask up only halfway to eat the nuts. And he says, she asks him, does he think this was Calvary? And of course, he definitely says one could ascertain that. You know, he has that great way of speaking.
Right.
And did we mention last episode he's in that movie where Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, is that most recently he's in The Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
That's right. Yeah,
the Coen Brothers movie came out last year.
Oh, he's so good. Okay, anyway. So then she asks, did Judd suffer? And he goes through kind of step by step of what Judd did go through and ascertains that, yes, he did suffer. He was alive the whole time until he wasn't.
Yeah, so that they actually, you know, pulled him up and he strangled to death as opposed to killing him first and hanging him, or even, you know, how an execution hanging would be where you drop them and try to break their neck. So,
yeah. So pretty terrible stuff. Then LG goes on to say he was at y'all's house for supper. Was he drunk? Was he high? I love her response. She says, he might have done some blow. And yeah. then his reply was, sounds like quite a party. And she was like, my kids were there. To which he says very sarcastically, your kids? And then she has maybe the best line of the show, of the episode, says, fuck you, you shiny fuck.
Right.
You interrogating me now? And he was like, well, why would I interrogate you? And she said, because you're a stone cold, you're a cold motherfucker, Glass. And then he says, well, then why am I crying under here? Meaning right. his mask. So we got to see just a touch of softness there from him. But their conversation is cut short because I'm calling these folks drone moths. They call them moths, but these are reporters kind of wearing these weird jacked up flying suits. I guess like drones or like drone technology, but of course not internet controlled. But they are kind of being shot down from the sky, not being hurt, just their cameras are being shot out of
right.
their hands, and then they're falling. So this is clearly the tactics that the reporters are using to try to get in close. And it was kind of fun. As one of them is shot down on the ground, Red Scare runs over to him and just proceeds to just beat the shit out of him.
Yeah, Red Scare is definitely the angriest of our detectives.
Yeah.
And I love when they tell me, I have a right to be here, you fascist.
So, yeah, or call
I'm
him
not
Nazi.
Fascist, I'm communist. Yeah, I'm not a Nazi, I'm communist.
I'm a communist. Yeah, it was a good line. It was good. Yeah, I'm interested in seeing more of him as well. But LG is just fascinating to me. Looking Glass. Anyway, so then they all are standing there realizing that no one's in charge. They kind of have this like, well, who's in charge?
Yeah.
And finally, Angela says, we need to get him down. Which, surprising, that wasn't the first thing they did at this crime scene, but hell, I don't know how a crime scene works. Anyway, we get this really nice scene of them bringing his body down off the tree, and she's kind of just hugging his dead body. And that is a nice flashback to what happened in The White Knight. Or during The White Knight. So we had questions. In fact, I have a list that we'll talk about at the end of this episode of we had so many answers, I felt like. Yes, we got a lot more questions this episode, but we got a lot of answers too. So I have a list of all the answers we got, and I have The White Knight as one of them.
Okay.
So flashback, we see it's Christmas Eve. Cal and Angela are in their home. It's a few minutes till midnight. Cal is talking about how he's going to open his present at midnight. She's trying to distract him and teach him some patience. She distracts him the only good way, I think, that's going to take his mind off that present.
Is by opening up his present. Woo!
But they are interrupted as shooters bust in Rorschach masks. Some cool ass in the dark fighting here we see from Angela. I guess Cal goes and hides. It's unclear where Cal goes in this shot, in this fight, but
right.
there's definitely...
She throws him to the side, so we don't see him
right.
after that.
And then there's definitely two
yes.
assailants.
Yeah.
She manages to lure them, one of them into the kitchen and manages to throw a knife in him, but then is shot in the gut by the other. And here's, I guess, a question that I guess we'll get more of, but as that shooter who shoots her in the gut is closing in on her, it cuts to her in the hospital bed.
Right.
So we never really understand how she escaped death here. Because it looked like he was closing in to shoot her in the head.
He was, I can't remember if he actually touched her, but I mean, he had the barrel like in her nose if he wasn't even like rubbing it on her face or something. So yeah, he could have easily killed her. So I think we're definitely going to see the end of this scene at some point. And I think it'll probably be a big, somewhat of a reveal or something.
It's gotta be. And it has to be mixed up with Judd, right? It's gotta be. So she wakes up in the hospital bed. Judd is by her side. His arm is in a sling. She immediately asks where Cal is, which is as you would do. And he says, you know, he's been by your side for the last 3 days. I finally sent him home for a shower. So we know that she's been out of it for 3 days. And then she calls him Chief, and he says Judd. So this is maybe the first time.
Well, she calls him Captain. He's not the Chief.
Yeah, that's right, Captain. That's right, Captain. And he like almost says it like, call me Judd. He says Judd. Right. So this is the first time they're ever really being informal with right. one another. Possibly the first time they're ever really speaking.
Right.
You know, one on one. But he says, he explains how they came for everybody. It was a coordinated attack. 40 houses, all police, on Christmas Eve, most of them asleep in their beds. She asks about her partner Doyle, and he says Doyle and his wife Ginny were in their bed, and that is where we found them. And their son Christopher took the little girl and the baby and hid in the closet. To which Angela says, Topher. He goes by Topher.
Right.
So maybe a lot of people don't know this, Dean, but you're also a Christopher. Did you ever go by Topher?
No, because I'm not a douche.
So we get a little interesting to know now that Topher and the two little girls are actually her partner's kids, and it's quite evident that she knew them enough to know that his son, whose name is Christopher, but he goes by Topher, so she clearly knew them well, and this is how she came, she and Cal came to adopt them. So it really cleared up the confusion with just that one little line of how they came to be this blended family, which was certainly some questions we had in our last podcast. And shout out to our great fan on Twitter. And apologies also for mispronouncing his name. We now know Roby. Roby, hello, Roby. You were right. You tweeted us that we got some answers this week about Angela's kids. We sure did. So shout out to you, Roby, and thank you for tweeting with us. And please continue to do that. And we will continue to make sure we say your name right going forward. All right. So then Angela says, okay, we're going to get together and go out and get these racist fucks, right? So she's, you know, even lying in the hospital bed, she's ready to get up and fight again. And Judd says there's nobody left. The entire force resigned because, you know, they're all afraid now.
Right.
And she says, well, I'm not fucking quitting. And he says, well, then I guess I won't quit either. And then he takes her hand in his and tells her it's okay to cry. She says maybe later. Detective Abar, and this is when she says Angela. So right. Again, this kind of first time intimate face-to-face discussion with them. He tells her it's okay to cry, and she puts her hands entwined with his. You can tell this is the start of what feels like a very genuine friendship between them. And then the last line is him saying, I'm sorry I let you down. And as we're getting that voiceover, it's cutting back to them zipping his dead body up in the bag.
Yeah, this whole scene it definitely called back to him comforting the police officer's wife that was shot in episode one. Mm-hmm. Even to the point to where moves to hold her hand. And like, so you get this feeling how, and I think we mentioned this last week, how just charismatic and how, much of a people person that Judd is, as far as he is very good at comforting people. He's very good at making people like him. He's a very likable person.
Yeah. And not only that, but comforting two strangers.
Right. Yes.
You know, that he's meeting for the first time who are both black ladies.
Right.
Not a thing a racist does, right?
I wouldn't think so. I don't know.
That's a pretty good cover up for a racist to be, if you're going to take a black woman's hand and hold it so gently and lovingly.
Yeah. And so I wonder, you know, it does make me feel that the more, and obviously we're going to pull this back a little bit later on, but we talked already how he doesn't wear the mask. And it is mentioned in the article on this week's Pedopedia that because he is the chief, that is part of the new act where he has to remain unmasked because he is in leadership position.
Right.
But, you know, I think you even talked about how he wears his hat. He wears it as a mask, but maybe we're seeing that basically his personality and his demeanor might be his mask.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know. I feel like it's just not going to be as cut and dry that, oh, this dude is a racist and a KKK. I just can't. There's got to be more to it.
Oh, I definitely think there's more to it.
All right. So we'll continue to unpack that. But back to so after they zip up Judd's body, that leaves Sister Night and Red Scare and LG kind of standing around saying, now what? And Red says, we're going to roll into Nixonville and round everybody up. And this is a great scene. I really noticed Angela's eyes in this scene, how white mm-hmm. and gorgeous they were
yeah.
in stark contrast to all the black around her face, her black mask and her black hood. And it was just really beautiful, but very striking. But she suggests they should stop and take a breath. And Red Scare, just the best, says, you don't want to beat the shit out of these fucks. And then he looks to LG and says, she loves beating shit out of fucks. And and then he finally looks back at her and says, okay, so are you coming or are you breathing?
Right. Well, I think LG even says, when he says that to him, he's like, that is indisputable.
Yes. Such great, great dialogue between these three. So back to being outside of Nixonville. I liked that we got a little bit more of old Nixonville, too.
Right.
All the police are held up outside. Red Scare is with a megaphone, shouting for everybody's going to come out in an orderly fashion, get into the paddy wagons for, you know, some questioning, or they're going to tear down their idol,
yeah.
Which they're not clearly threatened by at all. So it doesn't take long for the police to move in with full-on brutality, tasers, dogs, what have you, and they're just rounding everybody up out of Nixonville. And Angela, kind of standing off on the side with LG, still maintains that this shit is unnecessary, but even as somebody moves in to attack them, she doesn't think twice about just totally beating the shit out of that dude. I mean, she pummels that guy.
Yeah, I think that also shows, again, kind of like when she walked into her little cage and screamed before she put on the mask, she wasn't intending to, like, this was her emotions, like, this
oh,
way
sure.
of she was basically grieving at that point, taking her anger out on this guy. But I think she was legitimately kind of sickened by the fact that it's just back and forth brutality at this point, because they do something, we're going to go in and just, you know, beat the hell out of people or be just as bad. And again, it's that juxtaposition of, there are plenty of, it seem to be plenty of minority cops they've already shown here, but they're acting just as bad as the police, you know, from Jim Crow era or from this 1921 massacre that we saw in the first episode. And now are they just as bad as them, regardless of their race?
Yeah. That's a good question. Again, blurred lines between what is good, what is evil, black, white, lollipops, rainbows.
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely not, it's not a good look, right? It's not a good look what they're doing here.
No.
But it definitely shows how much maybe the entire police force was attached to Judd. I mean, they're all pretty emotionally charged.
Oh, for sure. Again, and you think about even, you know, obviously there's all examples right now in our world of police misconduct, but we've had several incidents over the past few years of, you know, police officers sitting in their car and someone walking up to them and shooting them in their car. And then how you always wonder, well, do the police then, does that cause police to then act even more aggressively, you know, as far as it's just, is it chicken and egg type of thing where
right.
once you're in that perpetual cycle, at what point does someone just say, like, you can't retaliate, you know, there has to be a stopping point.
Well, I believe it's kind of like one of the golden rules, Dean, that we've all learned maybe as early as kindergarten, maybe even earlier. And that is simply two wrongs don't make a right.
Oh, I was taught if somebody messes with you, you beat the shit out of them. Out of them fucks.
Yeah. Well. Well.
But I grew up in Leningrad. So. Yeah.
All right. So back in her civvies, I said, "Boy, Angela wears some cool clothes too when she is portraying her Angela persona. She looked great. I love her outfits. Loved her hair in this scene. So she's back at her civvies and she is taking that mug to the Greenwood Center for Cultural Heritage. And there are, of course, picketers out front of this place talking about how red furations are an abomination. She ignores them, marches right on inside. And the history of Tulsa 1921 is on display there. And this was really interesting. A little bit of exposition done in the style of, you know, like a cultural center display.
Right.
She approaches a machine, which is an interactive machine. So there's some good technology going on here without the internet. So it was a little curious. But on the screen, she hits a button and on the screen pops in U.S. Treasury Secretary Henry Louis Gates Jr. And it really is Henry Louis Gates Jr. And I don't know if you're familiar with that show on PBS called Finding Your Roots. It's actually, I've actually watched this show. This man hosts it.
Right.
He interviews various celebrities, a lot of African-American celebrities, right, but not all, where he traces their, it goes through and kind of traces their genealogy and they learn history of their family and their heritage. So I love that he's in this role now of helping Angela find her roots.
I do like that Lindelof continues this concept of, because it's an alternative history, it's still people we like are familiar with, but they're just in different roles.
Yeah, exactly. So she's interacting with Henry Louis Gates Jr. in this machine. She says her name is Will. I don't know if I mentioned that when she was speaking with Will back in the bakery, that he does say his name is Will. So we do have his name now as Will. He gives the history of Black Wall Street. So we see that kind of go by on the screen. And then he does say about how on behalf of President Robert Redford, the U.S. government would like to sincerely apologize to everybody and their families who've been affected by this. And would she, then it asks, would she consent to a test? To which she has to say yes, and then give a sample of her DNA, and a little cotton swab pops out from the machine, which she swabs the coffee mug and puts right back in.
Right.
And then he asks for a phone number to reach her for results, and she gives a phone number. And Dean, did you dial this phone number?
I didn't.
Well, I did, okay. And too bad it leads to nothing. Aww. I thought, oh gosh, here we go. Because a lot of times this will happen with Lindelof, especially. You know, there'll actually be something. They do this on Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad. Anytime there's a phone number in those shows, you could dial it and it would be, there was one, I think you could actually dial and hear Jesse's voicemail in Breaking Bad. So there have been some content like that that's been done as supplemental to the show. So I thought this was a perfect example to be able to do that. But too bad, when you dial the number, which by the way is 539-176-2442, when you dial it, it just leads to a nothing. It's a nothing number, an incorrect dial number or something. So anyway, so she completes that, heads back to her house, and did you notice on her front porch is an American flag waving, as people have American flags on their front porch, but did you notice the difference in the design of that flag, Dean?
Yeah, it's got the spiral of stars. It actually kind of reminded me more of like the Betsy Ross flag, but with all the 50, I guess the 51st star in the middle, I'm assuming.
Or, it was a complete redesign of the flag where the red and white stripes are still present in the background, but it's a big blue circle kind of in the middle of the flag now with the 51 stars. So interesting design, a nice little touch there to that. But there's a man waiting on their front porch, and we know this man, speaking of Breaking Bad, I didn't even do that intentionally, but tying it in here, this is a great actor, Jim Beaver. On her porch. Did you recognize him from Breaking Bad?
Who is he in Breaking Bad?
So he's the man, and he's also in Better Call Saul, but he's the one who sells the guns.
That's right. Yep.
The secret gun seller guy. So this is a big time actor, right?
Yeah.
We're going to see more of him.
Oh yeah, for sure.
It is clear that he is the grandfather of the kids. So this must be, you know, Doyle or Doyle's wife's father. And, he's clearly not in approval of Angela and Cal raising his grandkids. He definitely says, you know, it's his visitation, and Cal's inside. He knows he's inside, but too much of a pussy to answer the door. And she's, you know, she's like, this is just not a good time. Can't we take a rain check? You know, she knows she needs to let her kids know about Judd, and you know, this is just bad timing all the way around, but there's clearly these two don't like each other.
Right.
So she says, can't we take a rain check? And he says, no, but I can take a real check.
Yeah.
So he's happy to take money over spending time with his grandkids. So she happily writes him a check, and he makes a snarky remark about how those red furations are certainly paying off for her. She tears the check off and hands it to him and says, get the fuck off my porch. So more to come from this man, I'm sure. Inside, the little girls are playing with Cal, kind of a little funny game. He's a ghost. One's a pirate. One's an owl. They say they're going to drown him and feed him to the sharks. Angela says, we better go find some rocks then so that he doesn't float away. And so as they run off, we get this really nice conversation between Angela and Cal. Clearly, Angela has filled Cal in at some point through the day because he knows about Judd already. He asks if she's arrested the old man yet.
Right.
She says not yet because she's pretty certain that he didn't do it. And then he gets very quiet and asks if they're safe. And she says she'd tell him if they weren't. And he does mention that there's a visitation going on over at Judy's Cal's wife, right? Anyway, at the Crawford house tonight, and that she should go. He'll stay home with the kids. And she asks, how did Judy sound? And he said, you know, that she sounded fine, but he could tell that she's, you know, putting on a front just like Angela is. And then she goes to talk to Topher in his room. I just love Cal. He is a great husband. I really hope nothing happens to him.
He makes a comment too about, she says when she's talking about Will, about how he said, oh yeah, he says he's Dr. Manhattan because he's like took his human form. And even Cal makes another comment. Well, he can't do that.
Yeah. He's on Mars anyway.
It's funny that, you know, the fact that they keep saying it just makes it seem like, hey, make sure you know that he can't become somebody. Cause you know, my theory was that he might be Veet. But I'm not sure if I'm just going to stick with that, but they are throwing hints out there that, hey, Dr. Manhattan could now have the power. Are you sure he doesn't have the power to do this? Cause he's been gone a while.
And they also, they do reiterate too, it couldn't be him anyway because he's on Mars. Like, they're just so sure he's on Mars. And so, dun-dun-dun-dun, he's probably not.
Yeah, speaking of Mars, as she walks in to go talk with Topher, did anything look familiar to you that he was, that building he was building?
Yes. And I love this. So in Topher's room, he's building what can only be described as a magnetic floating castle.
Yeah, it was awesome.
There's a quick shot of the box on the floor. It does say Dr. Manhattan Blocks.
Yeah.
So it's branded properly and everything. Yeah. But yeah, 100%, that is the Dr. Manhattan / Vite Castle once again, right, in a new form. And it was what a cool toy. So
yeah,
for a world that doesn't have technology like we know it, it sure has a different type of technology, right, that almost in many ways is even more advanced than our technology.
Right.
So Angela starts to tell him about Judd. She says, you know, you and me, we don't do lollipops and rainbows because we know what the world really is, black and white. And then she says, your uncle Judd is dead. Topher takes the news pretty okay, says, you know, he was a policeman and policemen die. And he really wasn't my uncle anyway.
And then, I mean, and you can tell, just like everyone else in this episode, pretty much, he is holding back his emotion because he then lets his frustration out.
Yeah, and it was interesting. He says, don't tell Rosie and Emma, I'll tell them tomorrow. And she agrees to that. So, you know, and she also makes a mention of, like, you know what happened to my parents, or, you know, I saw what happened to my parents. You saw what happened to your parents. So clearly there's a little bit of a mystery surrounding, I guess, the death of her parents as well.
Right.
So maybe more to come on that. But yeah, he smashes his castle. A lot of work for a whole lot of nothing.
Well, I mean, Manhattan smashed that whole castle on Mars last week. So maybe... he's Dr. Manhattan. Topher Manhattan.
That's right. Well, but then he asks, can he watch some TV?
Yeah, yeah.
To which she says, yes, baby, you can.
Yep.
And I think the moment we've all been waiting for, the start of AHS, American Hero Story. We see Topher and Cal watching it. We also see a cut of LG watching it, eating a very sad TV dinner by himself.
Yeah.
We even see some of the 7th Cavalry have it on in the background watching it while they are building what can only be described as a bomb vest.
Yeah, a suicide vest of some sort.
So we get some different perspectives as this show within a show starts to unfold. And it's got this great, extremely extensive warning at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's got an X rating and basically a warning that how it's kids should not watch it, even if they're parentally supervised. It's pretty much going to offend everybody out there. It's got every bit of things you wouldn't want, right, children to see. It has all of it. It could offend LGBTQ.
Right.
Plus, it could offend. It's got misogyny. It's, yep, got brutality. All of it. So,
yeah, just another way they're showing how ultra liberal the country has become. And again, I think it's also Lindelof kind of winking, pushing back to the television world of what we are already becoming. I mean, you look at Netflix now. Ever since the whole issue with the I think the show's called The 13 Reasons Why, that came out a couple years ago about the kid who commits suicide. And that got so much backlash because they felt that it somehow glorified that now any, I mean, there's, I was watching something, I can't remember, maybe it was the beginning of The Politician, where they mentioned, yeah, about how it's, you're going to see a scene because, you know, the character in that commits suicide.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, now it's, well, there have been shows that show people die and, you know, commit suicide or other things for years upon years, but now it's, you know, well, someone might be triggered by it, so we got to make sure we put a warning in it, right? Like, and so it is kind of pushing off that yeah, maybe sometimes I guess the rating system always has been criticized, but, you know, now it's like, right, yeah, we got to make sure every single person basically knows that we're not going to get sued because you might be offended by this.
Yeah, that's funny. And also kind of a commentary on how it was reiterating multiple times how it's not for young children. But there's Cal sitting there letting Topher watching it without even a second thought. So also maybe showing how much, no matter how much those ratings are pushed out to the public, people still ignore them.
Right, yeah.
So that was funny. Anyway, but the show starts and it opens with a dead man being pulled from the river and a voiceover from Ralph Mueller. Here's, right, our Mueller name again. and he's the circus strongman, and he's dead. He says, "That's me, Ralph Muller, circus strongman, and I'm dead. But that's not really me. I just need the world to think it is, so that I can, you know, live in anonymity or whatever." So then we cut to some masked gunmen are about to rob a grocery store. Kind of a fun cut scene. They run past a kid selling newspapers,
yeah,
talking about how the alien invasion was the hoax. And so we know this is just right on the heels of the
War of the Worlds,
right? Radio broadcast that fooled so many people. What was that, back in the 30s?
Yeah, 30s or 40s. Orson Welles, right?
Right, Orson Welles. Thank you. So, so that was funny. But the masked gunmen run into a grocery store, start shooting the place up. They demand, the clerk opens the safe. They're demanding wallets and watches from all of the customers there. The clerk behind the counter keeps insisting there is no safe, which, did you catch when he's hunkered down on the ground? There is clearly a safe behind him. So annoying. But anyway, just as one of the gunmen is about to shoot a woman, Hooded Justice busts through the window, and he takes care of all of them and totally saves the day, including his final blow, crushing one man's head with the cash register.
Yeah, was awesome.
Was so great. And then we get this, then somebody in the grocery store asks him who he is, and we get this great Hooded Justice voiceover as Angela is driving out to the Crawford mansion. We hear Hooded Justice say how he was a kid so filled with anger that he only saw a stranger when he looked in the mirror, but putting on the mask allowed him and the stranger to become one. But who am I? If I knew the answer, I wouldn't be wearing this fucking mask. So it's definitely paralleling to Angela, I think, kind of the feeling she has about herself.
Right, absolutely. The fact that she, again, as we saw earlier, the anger comes out, and this is a way to push it towards something at least good.
Yeah.
Almost like if I wasn't this, I'd almost be just out there killing people.
So we're definitely going to get more of Hooded Justice, and I can't wait. Love it. But so far, not anything that deserves that kind of rating that it got.
No.
So far.
I don't know. It was a pretty brutal murder scene. To the point where even the people in the store, like the storekeeper was watching him smash that guy's hand. He was kind of like, ugh. And when he picks up the register, they even kind of give him a look like, oh, no, he's not going to smash his head, is he?
Yeah.
Bam.
Yeah. So anyway, back at the Crawford house, if I was calling her Judy earlier, I don't even remember now. I'm on too much cold medicine. Her name is Jane. I hear of it clearly in my notes. So Angela arrives. There are tons of people at Jane's house, including Senator Joe Keen, who comes up and introduces himself to Angela. We do get a little bit of Angela calls him Senator, and he says, no, just call me Joe. Only Jane has to call me Senator, because she works for me, and she says used to work for you.
Right.
So I don't know if that's going to mean much, but we know that Jane once used to work for Senator Joe Keen. He does say that, you know, any resources she needs, she has them to get to the bottom of who did this. And Angela reminds him that she's not a cop anymore. She retired. And he says, oh, yeah, right. Clearly doesn't believe her. And then she faints, which we know is now a fake-out faint. Very cleverly, she faints.
Mm-hmm.
Were you going to say something else about the scene before I move on?
Yes. The one of the PDPedia files, the one that's the article about Judd's death, actually mentions that he worked for Joe Keen Sr. on his security detail before he became a police officer.
Oh.
So he has connections. So they have family connections already.
Mm. So this Keen guy could also be bad news, and probably is, right?
Yeah, he kind of is being presented as like, well, I mean, he's a politician, but he already has that like false smarminess to him. You know, like he's going out of his way to seem like he's being overly friendly and everything.
Right.
But again, I think, just with Judd, maybe a lot of the feelings we're getting from these characters may be intentional, to where they are hiding other personalities. But yes, he does kind of come off like, this guy's something's wrong with this guy. He's a politician. Mm-hmm. He can't be trusted, but we'll see.
Yeah. So next scene, we see Angela is in one of the bedrooms here at the Crawford house. Jane is leaning in on her, telling her to take her time, you know, to rest and recuperate. Angela says, you know, I came over here to comfort you and, you know, you're ending up taking care of me and you've got so many friends out there waiting on you and don't worry about me. And Jane says some really nice words about, you know, you're my friend too. Take as much time as you need. She leans in really close and says, get the fuckers that did this to him. So clearly she knows who Angela is.
Right. They seem friendly from the dinner party that they had, but it does make it seem that she surely really cares about Angela. So if we are finding out that Judd was hiding things or if he had ill intent and the way he kind of lied to her about leaving, it doesn't seem like the wife is necessarily in on it.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with that. But she knows, do you think she knows Angela's secret identity?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay. Okay, so then a great scene scored by just more great, great Trent Reznor music here. Angela puts on these cool-ass glasses that can only be described as owl glasses. It's more of that night owl technology.
Yep.
She searches Judd's closet in the dark. So it was great. These are like infrared glasses, right? She finds a secret compartment in his closet. And when she opens it, only to reveal full-on KKK uniform hanging in there. Like a creepy, scary ghost costume. And she's clearly disturbed by it.
Right. And it has a sheriff's badge on it, too.
Yeah.
Which is weird.
Yeah, I didn't like that at all, Dean.
Yeah, and then we also get another look. They make sure to close in on that picture again that we saw last week of the man and boy.
So my theory, as I want to maintain that Judd was good, not bad. I don't know. But so my theory is that that man is his grandfather and that this was his grandfather's. And that Judd is still mixed up in it, it's because he was trying to reform people.
So this article also mentions his lineage.
Judd is a
fourth generation Tulsa police officer.
Okay.
So his father, his grandfather, and his great grandfather were all Tulsa policemen or Oklahoma policemen. His great grandfather was Dixon T. Crawford, a renowned cowboy marshal of Oklahoma's pre-statehood years. His grandfather had a 55-year career in the Tulsa County Sheriff's Department, and his father was a highway patrol officer who died in the line of duty in 1994. And his father has a twin brother who also worked at many police departments within the South and East Coast.
Well, there's always a twin floating around out there, isn't there?
Yeah. But the fact is, the grandfather being a cowboy marshal, I almost wonder, will we maybe find out that he was the who was being represented in that
movie
about Bass Reeves? Maybe he was the corrupt sheriff.
That's immediately where my head went. I was going to look back in my notes. Did they ever say his name in that silent film? Did they say?
I think they just referred him as the sheriff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then even more so, his grandfather, a 55-year career in the Tulsa County Sheriff's Department. So his grandfather had to have been there during the Tulsa riots.
Yeah.
Had to have been. And if he was there for 55 years.
So that's his grandfather's KKK uniform, most likely.
I think so. And the police were known to be very complicit with that. Not necessarily going out and doing the riots themselves, but letting people do it. And then they were going and rounding up blacks and basically detaining them to keep them from defending their homes and stuff. So they definitely were a part of that incident. So I don't think it was his. Now, the fact that he has it all displayed like that, as opposed to like hidden in a trunk somewhere, is weird.
I mean, why keep it? at all.
Maybe that was like when they were picking masks and costumes for the police. He was like, guys, check this one out. And they're like, I don't think so, Judd. Maybe you just shouldn't have a mask. He says, oh, okay. But he just left it propped up, like never put it away.
You clearly don't know how to make good disguise.
He's like, no, I'm the ghost sheriff. You know, I'm like, I'm the white knight. Yeah. With a K-N-I-G-O. Yeah, now I get it. Now I get why this is bad. Maybe I shouldn't do this.
Oh.
That was his failed costume idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is why they don't let him trick-or-treat.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so as she leaves the house, we do get this close-in camera pans in on a close-in shot of a painting hanging on the Crawford's wall. This is a real painting, and the title of this painting is actually Comanche Feats of Horsemanship. So this is where we get the play of the title of our actual episode. And what's depicted in this piece of artwork here, this is a real famous painting, and apologies, I don't have the artist's name written down, but it does depict Native Americans using their horses as shields during battle. So it's very reminiscent of a commentary overall on our characters, you know, wearing masks and disguises, but also even last episode, you know, hiding behind the cows during the battle. So did you have any other takeaways from this painting or see any other significance there about it?
It did make me immediately think of Buster Scruggs. If you watched that on Netflix last year when it came out, the last, I think it's the very last, no, it's not the second, it's the second to the last vignette with where they're out on the prairie and there's that awesome gun battle between the cowboy and the Indians, which I guess were Comanches. I don't know what they were supposed to be, but they almost get him because the last rider, he's a lone horse wandering by. And then all of a sudden, right when it gets to him, the guy swings up from the side of the horse where he was hiding and actually pulls that move.
Yeah. So that was real battle tactics.
Yeah. So I don't know if it's another nod to a lot of our characters are hiding behind a mask or they're hiding behind basically they're
a prop of some sort.
Yeah, they're always hiding behind something. What you think you're about to see, this lone horse, all of a sudden, boom, there's something behind that. Mm-hmm. So that could be any of them. It could be any of them, just their mask. It could be, again, Judd's persona could be his horse, or his badge could have been the horse, and he was hiding something behind that. There's a lot of ways we could take it. But it definitely is that feigned strategy. You're faking one thing to do something else.
Right, right. So, and plus that created a great segue for us to cut over to see what's happening with Vite, who's also riding on horseback through his estate. Fun little scene, you know, and what is this actor? Jeremy Irons, right?
Yes.
He's killing it. He's so great in this role. I loved this whole scene again with Vite. This was perfect, this episode. So he picks a tomato from a tree. So he's got trees growing tomatoes, Dean. And the tomato looked great. He takes a bite of it, undetermined if he is dissatisfied with it or just enjoys being wasteful. But he takes one bite from it and then just crushes the rest and drops it on the ground. We cut to him back at his dining room table with the same cake. This time the cake has two candles in it. They are Crookshanks and Mr. Phillips are singing "For He's a Jolly Good Fellow" again to him.
So do we take that to mean a year's gone by since the last time we saw him?
You know, I don't know.
If it's an anniversary?
Who knows how they're measuring time over there in crazy Vite world land.
Right.
But I do love his annoyance with them singing, and he says, "Just get on with it," to which they continue singing very fast.
Yes.
They finish up. They can't just stop singing. They have to finish the song. So they just speed it up, which was hilarious. I don't know. I'm not sure the milestones of this anniversary, because they were telling him last episode, we're celebrating an anniversary, and we got the cake with one candle. And this is an anniversary with two candles.
So
I don't know about a year. Clearly, they're celebrating. I felt like they're celebrating some sort of milestone with the play, because before the play unfolds, it's clear. It's evident they've been doing this a while.
Yeah. So, again, the obituary that was pushed out last week, it says he was declared missing in 2012. And so it's 2019 now. So I almost wondered if maybe this is going from the past, from when he eventually, from whatever has happened, whether he voluntarily has gone to wherever this place is, or if he was put wherever this place is, but maybe we're going to be building up to
that. Makes sense.
Where, you know, when he'll meet up with the present.
Sure. So we're still seeing past visualizations. We're seeing past scenes of him. He's not caught up to present yet.
I think that's one interpretation that we can see.
And I still, there's a lot of speculation out there about, you know, this, him being a secretly Dr. Manhattan, or somehow Dr. Or, you know,
trapped him somewhere or something. Yeah.
And
that.
I believe, you know, you talked about that theory, on our last episode, and that would make sense then. That we're going to see his evolution up till the reveal at the end.
I also have an explanation for the tomato tree.
Ooh, let's hear it.
So one of his last successful endeavors that he kind of, I guess, made big in the late 90s, early 2000s, was he had a company, Vite Enterprises was a major company for genetic engineering, and they were known for genetically engineering food. So I'm assuming this is one of his creations, this tomato tree, as opposed to just a tomato vine, or maybe some kind of hybrid of apples and tomatoes or something.
Yeah, I want one.
But then also said he started getting into pet cloning, which became popular because, you know, he had that lynx in the past that he made. But I almost wonder if maybe he got into some other cloning as well.
I think it's safe to say that he most likely did.
Yes.
So he, after Crookshanks and Mr. Phillips finish singing, he asks Crookshanks, when is a lie not a lie? And she says, when it's acting, sir. And he says, okay, real tears tonight. And then Mr. Phillips reminds him that he needs the watch that he gave him as a prop. And I love this line. He turns to Mr. Phillips and says, has it occurred to you, Mr. Phillips, that you are a prop?
Right.
And Phillips says, would you like it to occur to me, sir? To which Vite says, there are so many things I would like to occur to you. So he's clearly annoyed with the lack of intelligence in these folks. And we'll come to learn how disposable they really are.
Yes.
But cut to the play. We actually see the play. We've got Crookshanks and Phillips on stage portraying John and Janie. And we've got other, Vite is in the audience watching. There are other people around all wearing hoods over their faces, and they're playing the instruments or the music to set the tone for this production. Sometimes they're playing violins, sometimes drums, depending on the tension they're trying to create. So he's got the full production, full force, right? Just like we know how Dr. Manhattan was created. This is the creation of Dr. Manhattan. So John tells Janie that he's going to go fetch her watch. He's finished preparing her watch, and he's going to go fetch it from the intrinsic field generator. But once he gets inside that intrinsic field generator, oh no, he's trapped and can't get out. And then he is horribly incinerated.
Yes.
Yeah. And I, first time watching this, I was like, wait, what? What? They're really burning him. This is what's happening here. So he's really being set on fire and killed for real. Real screams. Vite is clearly moved by Crookshanks's real tears that she is shedding here. And then we see the scene of Dr. Manhattan emerge as he's being brought down from the sky and onto the stage. He's all blue. He's naked, as we know Dr. Manhattan to be. And he announces that now he's Dr. Manhattan. And Janie exclaims, oh, John, is this the end? And he replies, nothing ends, Janie. Nothing ever ends. And then that's the end of the play. Vite really enjoys it. He is congratulating them all the hooded musicians, and including the character, the actor who's playing the Dr. Manhattan. They all remove their hoods to reveal that they're all a bunch of Phillips and Crookshanks.
Yes.
So we now know that he is making clones of these people. They're not real people, which is why he could so cavalierly just allow one of them to burn up.
Yeah, and I think we can also say they're definitely not robots, right? Because he definitely had a burned body, not just a metal husk or anything.
That's right. So they're cloned people, so creepy and scary. One of the clone Mr. Phillips is removing the dead corpse from the incinerator, and he asks Vite if he should be taken to the basement with the others. Vite says, "What's your name?" He says, "Montrose, sir." He says, "Montrose, how would you like to be the new Mr. Phillips?" Montrose is like, "Absolutely, I would." So he knows he's, you know, going to be incinerated here at the next performance as the role of new Mr. Phillips. Vite says, "Yeah, take him to the basement with the others. We'll have a use for them before too long." Mm-hmm. So whatever he's doing, he's got dead bodies piling up. I guess he's planning to make use for them, but hold on, he does remember to retrieve his watch from the dead corpse's hands. Miss Crookshanks asks if it's still working, or has it stopped? And he gives it a little click or gives it a little like slap, and it's still ticking. And then he says ominously, "No, it hasn't stopped. It's only just begun." Mm-hmm. So what a great fun scene. Love the reveal of the clone people. I like that we get this kind of, you know, background reminding people of Dr. Manhattan's origins, because we know this is going to become important,
right,
in the show. So,
and again, if it's not hinting that maybe he is Dr. Manhattan, he's obviously showing an obsession of Manhattan.
Absolutely.
Even that line at the end where he says nothing ever ends, that's the last line that Manhattan says to Vite before he goes to Mars.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so also, but hold on, he's cloning people. He clearly has the ability to clone people, when earlier in this episode, we've heard it maintained by several folks that Dr. Manhattan doesn't have the ability to look like them.
Right.
Here we're seeing that someone's got the ability to make people who look like people.
Right.
So whether it's Dr. Manhattan or Vite or something else, I'm very excited for that mystery to continue to unfold. I'm so excited to see more Phillips and Crookshanks. And I guess I should have mentioned, too, that both Phillips and Crookshanks throughout the play did mess up their lines and did have to get a line reading from Vite out in the audience, to which he was very annoyed. Yeah. So even though he's making clones, he's obviously annoyed by their imperfections. Which is why he can so callously allow them to just burn up and die.
And I almost wonder, too, if he's annoyed at them, but I also wonder if it's maybe because it annoys him that he didn't get it perfectly type of thing. Like, if he's that, I mean, he seems like that egotistical of a person it reminds him of a slight failure on his part.
Right. Yeah. Good point. Yeah. If it's not perfect, it's not worth having. All right. Our final scene. Oh my gosh, we're there. Back at the bakery. Oh, I just loved it. I just love Louis Gossett Jr. What a treasure he is. So back at the bakery, we can see the handcuff is no longer binding Will. But he's still in the bakery, still in his wheelchair. Now he's at the stove and he's boiling some eggs. She walks in and sees that he is free, asks where he got the eggs. He says he went to the store across the street. She is dismayed. Says, "You mean you left and came back?" And he says, "Yeah, we still had more things to talk about."
Right.
And so she pulls the KKK robe out of her bag, says, "You know, did you plant this in Crawford's closet? Because it was really fucking easy to find." And he does make a remark about, you know, "Was it on the second floor? You do realize it's not very easy for me to go upstairs." And she, let's see. He also makes a remark about how he's going to be rescued anyway, pretty soon or something. And
right.
Says, "You're going to be rescued. What are you talking about?" And he says he has friends in high places.
Yeah. He also seemed very almost like he made it clear that that robe doesn't even seem like it's an important thing in the grand scheme of whatever conspiracy he's talking about, because he was just like, where'd you find that? Like literally in his closet. I just meant figuratively.
Yeah. Yeah. That was a funny line. And is this where he says, I have so much to tell you, but I can't tell it to you all at once because your head would explode?
No, or you already said that earlier.
That was earlier. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, so she's still trying to get answers, and he's being very cat in the canary, right?
Yes.
He's being very sheepish and, you know, like, I'm not going to give you straightforward answers. He's enjoying the game.
Yep.
Then she gets the call and learns that Will is eligible for Red Ferations. And then she also learns that, furthermore, she is his direct descendant. In fact, she is his granddaughter. I loved that reveal.
Right. And I love that she tries to hide it from him, and he's just like,
he knows.
He even says, yeah, I thought it was time we got to know each other, or I wanted to learn something about you. So basically saying, like, I know who it was. I don't have to say, like, we both know I know who it was.
He says, your parents didn't tell you anything about me.
Yeah.
And she's like, nope, not a thing. And she says, why are you here? And he just says, I wanted to meet you and show you where you came from. And at that point, you could just tell she still doesn't completely believe him. She kind of snaps out of this, like, confusion and just starts reverting to just police procedure. And she says, okay, you're under arrest, you know? So she wheels him out to her car. There's this beautiful, sweet moment. And you have to imagine that she's already done this once, because she's already loaded him into her car one time, but we didn't see it when she was bringing him from the tree to the bakery. Mm-hmm. But here we see her having to clearly lift him and put him into her car. And it's as she lifts him, you can feel this like tenderness, this loving kind of like familial bond, for a flash moment there. As she's just carefully lifting him and placing him. He's a delicate old man, right?
Right.
And she's putting him in the car.
And it also reminded me of how she stopped with Judd when they were pulling him out of the tree. It was that same, as opposed to where it was like, then she was losing a father figure and now maybe she's gaining a father figure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Good parallel there too. But before she could even get in the car, or before she could even load his wheelchair into the car, this what can only be disguised as a flying magnet.
Yeah, magnets,
comes
bitch.
From the sky. Yeah, emerges from, I guess, a ship, a spaceship from the sky. The magnet comes down, grabs hold of the van and lifts it up into the sky, carrying Will off in her car. And don't worry, that note flutters down onto the ground into Angela's hands. The same note that's been following Will. Okay, following Will throughout the last two episodes, the Watch Over This Boy note, and now Angela has it.
Yeah, it was a great little reveal. Like, I mean, if you noticed maybe the second time you watched, because I didn't notice the first time, he gives away that something's about to happen, because as they're going to the car, he already is like looking up into the air.
Yeah.
Like he knew this person's there. I mean, well, he already said
friends in high places.
Yeah. And then of course, as soon as right before the car, you know, gets slipped in the sky, there's a great look between them and Angela looking at him just like, oh my God, you were telling the truth about everything.
Yeah.
And then this is the point where, like I said, at first he seems like such an unreliable character. But now, maybe all this is true.
Could he be working with Dr. Manhattan? Could he, this somehow be tied up with, I feel like it's got to be tied up.
I think he's working with Hooded somebody.
Justice. It's got to be tied up with Hooded Justice.
Yeah, there's a theory going that he might be Hooded Justice.
Perhaps.
Or that what he was Hooded Justice at some point, mm-hmm. which would, I guess, could make some sense. But yeah. And then the last line of the show was exactly what was running through my head. In fact, I might have actually said it right before Angela did. But when she just looks in the screen, screams, what the fuck?
Yeah. Great. It was great. And close out to the Beastie Boys, The Eggman.
Yes.
Was a great awesome. Closing number as the credits rolled. I just love this show so much. Oh, two episodes in and I am just enthralled. So a list of answers we got in this episode, okay? And tell me if you can think of any others as we're wrapping up here. We got answers on Angela's kids.
Yep.
We got answers on the White Knight.
Yeah, a little.
What occurred on the White Knight. Maybe unreliable narrator, but we got some answers. We got some answers on Will and who he is.
And a little bit about Angela's past, yeah.
Right. We got some answers on Veidt's clones.
Yeah.
And we got some answers on Redforations. I feel like a lot of the exposition that was done at that Heritage Cultural Center really gave us some background on the Redforations that have been distributed. And why.
Yeah, the third PDPedia file they released, this one was kind of the least, I guess, clue-like thing to the show, but it kind of gives some background. There is a it's like a court report, basically, of, I guess, when they argued for the Redfordations. And of course, it's being the argument in the Supreme Court was, what lawyer do you think was running this this argument for reparations?
Oh God, I heard it. I saw it. Tell me,
Johnny Cochran.
Yeah, I knew it. Of course. So I need to go back and revisit those PD files. So thank you for bringing that.
Like I said, they're great, especially because I know we talked about how we didn't read the full graphic novel. I think if you are watching this show and you like it and you only know The Watchmen through the movie, or you've looked and researched the graphic novel but haven't really gotten into it, these do a good job of giving you at least a kind of cliff notes of things that what you should know from the past, also bringing draws a bridge and connects from the original source material, the 30 years since then of what's been going on in this world.
So cool that they're doing that. I completely agree. And we'll continue to keep that link in our show notes with each episode. And of course, we'll continue to tweet out the PDPedia files, especially as new ones are added. I saw that you sent that tweet out earlier this week when the new files dropped. Looks like they're going to be adding content to it every week.
Yeah, in fact, I kind of just happened to think about it on Monday morning, and I went to look, and it had a file too. So I was like, oh, sweet, they're going to do this. Looks every week, probably. So.
And I should say, of course, there are a lot of other Watchmen podcasts out there, and a lot of folks get their podcasts out the very next day or within 2 days. But we, you know, we're running along, you know, parallel with Radio Labyrinth. And so because of the Radio Labyrinth episode comes out on Friday, I believe our episode will continue to drop on Sunday mornings. So you will get it before the next episode airs. And, you know, hey, someone's got to be last. So we're fine with that. I'm fine with a Sunday morning drop time for our. So continue to listen for us every Sunday morning, I believe, is when we're going to continue to get these Watchmen episodes out to you. I did want to briefly touch on, just real quick before we go here, we saw some previews for the next episode. We know we're finally getting Jean Smart in the next episode, because she was all over that trailer. In fact, it's my only note is she walks up and someone says, who the fuck are you? And her response is, I'm Laurie Blake. Who the fuck are you?
Yeah.
So already I love her. That's all I needed to see.
Yeah. I think we're also going to learn the identity of the lady who is getting the newspapers from the little girl.
Oh, good.
I believe that character's name is Lady True.
Okay.
And she is, I think she's going to be almost like a parallel to Veidt, because I think she's a billionaire. In fact, I think her business is what bought out Veidt Industries. So she's another kind of billionaire trying to take over the world. And we see a couple of clips of this Asian woman in the previews, and she looks like she is up to some world-changing things. In fact, I even think she makes the comment of, I'm going to save the world, or I'm going to change the world, or something. So,
okay, good. Well, I'm intrigued by new characters.
I think she might possibly end up being kind of the closest thing to a major villain of the show we're going to have this year.
Okay. And I don't think that we're going to see Will again for a while. And Angela is going to have a real struggle because she never told anybody about him being at the tree. Right. She removed him from the crime scene before anybody else saw him. She never really officially took him in or arrested him. The only person she told about him is Cal. And now he's been disappeared. You know, he's gone. He's undisappeared.
Yeah.
I think the audience is going to have to sit with that Will mystery for a little while.
Yeah, it can only be like 2 weeks, though, right? Like, they can't hold him off for that long.
We shall see.
All right.
Well, that's all I have for today. Dean, anything else before we close out?
Keep watching The Watchmen. Check out PDpedia for your additional supplements. I'm telling you, it makes it better. You'll get into it. I sit here and print them out and go through and highlight things at some point during the week when I probably should be doing more important things, but hey, I'm trying to solve this mystery.
That's right. Any other big predictions?
No, I have none. No prediction. I don't know. I'm waiting to find out.
Yeah. Well, excited for this Sunday and excited for the show that keeps me on my heels every week as I can't stop thinking about it. So, all right, Dean, thank you so much. You want to give our Twitter handles and we'll sign off here.
Yes, find us on Twitter at MikeTV1 is our show's and Lisa's kind of official Twitter. You can find me individually at Rockdale_Tiger. I tweet about Watchmen. It's during the fall, so if you are into college football, I tweet a lot about that as well. But if you have any questions, any comments, or anything you want us to catch, or maybe you know something we didn't catch, please tweet us at MikeTV1, and we'll make sure we mention you next week.
Yes, shout out to Roby again. Please, Roby, keep tweeting with us. Encourage your friends and everybody else to as well. We did start to set up a Gmail, but have failed to get the Gmail handle that we want to keep it the same. So I'm still working on what could be a good a name for our email. So if you have any ideas for that, send those our way too. We're going to have that email set up so that we can open up other lines of communication. And thank you everybody for listening. We will talk to you again next week.
Bye.
Bye.